Mike, Nick isn't here.
No.
I don't know how to feel about this.
It's not the same without Nick. I realized we went the entire last episode that he wasn't here without actually mentioning he wasn't here.
Yeah. It's definitely a different presence. Not only is a two-person podcast different than a three-person one, but Nick's presence is larger than life. We will, however, go on without him. And I understand he's probably out enjoying some pretty nice weather, so I can't really blame him per se, but I think we'll do everything we can to make him regret his decision to go outside.
Undoubtedly, we will.
Yes. All right. So I want to blast through the follow-up here because we do have some interesting stuff we want to talk about, and we tend to make this every week. There seems to be something new with Tesla and something new with SpaceX. And so these pieces of follow-up, I think it's interesting to discuss them for a little bit, but not necessarily dwell on them because there's a bunch of stuff in our actual stuff that happened last week that I really want to talk about too. And so I'll start with SpaceX, and I just wanted to get your thoughts on this plan that SpaceX put out this week to head to Mars, or at least leave for Mars by 2018 mm-hmm. with SpaceX. I don't know. What did you think when you read that?
Honestly, I'm not surprised, and it's almost to the point now, and it says a lot, I think, about where we are technologically, but for me, it's closer to being non-news now that we've already landed on Mars. Yeah. And it's like, let me know when we send a person to Mars. That's kind of where I'm at right now. I don't know if that's a good place to be at, but
it's not really clear to me whether they would send people in 2018. I don't think it is. They would be sending a vehicle, but they wouldn't be sending people on this first trip.
Yeah. The article that you linked says the company is also developing a second version of the craft to carry astronauts into space.
Because this one's
the
pretty
new
small.
Version is the one that will go to Mars. Yeah. So
he says it's the size of an SUV internally. And I guess that would make for a very comfortable 6-month flight. If you imagine going on a 6-month road trip where you cannot leave the vehicle or you will die of asphyxiation. Can we just crack the windows? No, we cannot.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm excited because as far as I know, this seems like the most realistic aspiration from a private company to actually do something like this. And yeah, this came alongside also this week. Apparently, SpaceX got their first military contract, which is a first for a private American company to be helping. I guess it's NASA because NASA does military stuff as well, but to help NASA with a military mission as opposed to just a civilian or like experimental scientific mission. So, it's exciting stuff. It's their Red Dragon. I guess it's the Dragon spacecraft that Elon says in this tweet that he wants to be able to land anywhere in the solar system. I assume he means like planetary bodies, like rocky planets and not necessarily Jupiter, Saturn, or the sun.
But I wouldn't put it past him.
No, I agree with you, but they would have to name their space landing probe Icarus, I have to assume, because it would burn up pretty quickly. But it definitely seems like it has to be the future of space is going to be helped hugely by SpaceX's kind of, they don't have to report back to the American public. Like they're not using taxpayer dollars for this. Except for the ones where they're government contracts, but they're not directly kind of funded by a taxpayer directly, where they're going to be accountable to the taxpayers for whatever moonshot they decide to take. Like this Mars mission wouldn't be publicly funded unless NASA was getting on board to do some kind of experiments along the way. But yeah, I think it's a really awesome endeavor, and I now can't wait for 2018. I was really excited for 2017 with the Tesla 3. And now I have to wait until 2018 for something else cool to happen.
Yeah, it's interesting how much of a long play this privatized space development is, because it's kind of similar to alternative energy, which coincidentally Tesla is also involved in, or at least Elon Musk is. But it's the kind of thing where it's not a huge market now. And if anything, they're losing money on whatever they're doing. Yeah. But I think the precedent they're setting and the expectations they're generating, both for themselves and for competitors, is the best thing that they could be doing.
Yeah.
Because they're basically like the ubiquitous company to do any kind of thing like this. Like, if you're not using SpaceX, you're not doing anything almost at this point. Like, and kind of the same thing with Tesla. Like, you're involved in the electric car space, but if you can't match what Tesla is doing and you have the same kind of appeal and technology that Tesla is using, then it's like, what are you even doing? Mm-hmm. Because they have been first to market and they've done it very well so far.
Yeah. It's very interesting to see, to kind of experience it, because I mean, yeah, the whole military thing is going to be interesting, because as far as I know, that would be not publicized. And so far, most of what we've seen with SpaceX, they've been trying to make as public and transparent as possible. This is going to be kind of a shift for them to like, hey, we're going to launch our military satellite. We're going to stream our military satellite launch. And it's like, no, we're not going to do that actually.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I'm assuming there's a lot of revenue generated from the military side.
Yeah.
Just because of how much money goes into military funding, especially in the US. So potentially that's kind of a paying the bills projects, and then they can afford the moonshots,
right?
Both metaphorically and not metaphorically.
Yeah. In theory, I think I said it. I don't remember if I said that they were the first company to get military contracts. I don't think they actually are, thinking back. Like, there's companies like Boeing or Lockheed Martin that have also had military contracts with the states. But if I did say that, that was a mistake. And I might have said something similar to that that's still true. So, but yeah, they're not the first to do this, but they're definitely seem to me like the most modern thing. And it's happening in our time, which we haven't seen any of while we've been kind of conscious of this.
Yeah. Well, like I said before, it's amazing that we're at the point where I can read that a private company is planning to go to Mars, like send a shuttle or a rocket or a lander to Mars. And it's like, it's like not to that extent, but it's like, oh, that's good.
Yeah.
But it's not like, what? Yeah. How could they even do that? It's like, I'll be impressed when I see a person on Mars.
Yeah, for sure. So the next piece of follow up here is from Tesla. And it's from Volvo technically, but talking about Tesla and basically hyping their own autonomous, like semi-autonomous driving system, and throwing shade at Tesla's system for being super primitive. Like, Volvo, as far as I know, doesn't have any cars with any kind of self-driving capabilities outside of maybe parking or, you know, the lane assist, those technologies that exist in cars right now. But basically saying, you've seen Tesla's self-driving system. The self-driving system we're going to launch that you haven't seen anything about yet, it's going to be so much better. We're testing it right now. And so apparently, I think we might have touched on this before, but they've come up with a kind of system of levels of autonomy of self-driving cars. And basically the number you can get is, I think level one is something like the thing that most new cars have now, or the like self parallel parking thing where you just push the button. That would be level one. Like, that's the most basic kind of thing where it does this very small controlled, like the, we always talk in automation about solved problems. Like the game of checkers, I think, is a solved game. Parallel parking is a thing that if you follow an exact set of computational instructions, you will parallel park properly every single time. And so I think parallel parking is kind of a solved problem in AI for cars, but things like lane assist and brake assist and all of those kinds of technologies are level two technologies. And Tesla puts themselves in that camp where if something goes wrong, the system like sounds a warning in the car and says, take over control. We can't handle this. And then the system will just turn itself off. Cause it's basically saying like, Jesus, take the wheel. And if the driver passes out or something, that car is going to crash because the AI can only do so much. And they literally are legally saying, we are not responsible for a crash. You have to be paying attention. You have to have your hands on the wheel at all times, even if we're going to provide little assists. And the guy at Volvo who's working on this project, might even be the head of the project, says that the Honda technology is the next level up, where they can actually, in the case of an emergency, they will stop the car and pull over to the side of the road safely. Like, they'll finish the emergency, whereas Tesla is like, nope, we're not doing anything. It's your fault if you get in a crash still.
Yeah, I'm just looking up the autonomy levels. Mm-hmm. Because there is, like you said, there is a kind of system they've come up with. And there's one PowerPoint presentation from a .gov site,
right.
Elthis. And their scale's on 0 to 10.
Yeah.
But they've broken up into kind of like 5 subsections.
Okay.
So this basically goes from like 100% human interaction to high-level human with low-level tactical behavior and simple environment responsibilities by the autonomy. Yeah. And then there's your mid-level, which is mid-complexity multifunction, which is, I think, the level 2 that Tesla's is designed for.
Yeah.
And then the next level is low-level human interaction, where it's collaborative, high-complexity, difficult environment. And then your last level is approaching 0 human interaction.
Yeah.
So, there's kind of like anywhere from 3 to 5 levels, depending on if you consider the endpoints, like, you know, no human interaction, 100% human interaction as levels as well.
Yeah.
But you kind of have 3 main sub-levels in there. So,
right.
Volvo's thing is kind of weird. It's almost like they're saying, oh, well, we could have done that. Like, we just haven't yet.
Not yet.
Yeah. But you wait, you know. It's like the reason we don't have this yet is because we're working on something better.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's to be seen. And I don't doubt that, you know, every car manufacturer, you know, to be hyperbolic, but every car manufacturer will have some form of autonomy in their cars going forward. Yeah. Even if it's as simple as, you know, the self-parking type thing. It's almost the kind of thing where people will be looking for that when they're buying a new vehicle.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, the used vehicle market will still be around, and there will always be non-autonomous functionality in vehicles as long as there's used cars. But
yeah,
you'll see a convergence of autonomy, even if it's aftermarket autonomy. I wouldn't be surprised if you can start installing that type of system, because it is all just computer based functionality. So you can easily retrofit a car with that.
Right.
Easily, relatively you know, changing out an engine or something like that.
Yeah, there's a tech podcast I listen to, Accidental Tech Podcast. They're all kind of car guys. They started, it's called Accidental Tech Podcast because it used to be a car podcast called Neutral. And so with this kind of all the Apple car rumors, they tend to talk a lot about Apple because that's the ecosystem they're all in. With the talk of Apple car, they're like getting back into the car stuff. And they mentioned a really good point in, I think, the last episode, possibly one or two ago, about self-driving cars, in that, yes, cars like Tesla can handle highway driving and even kind of traffic in downtown, which they don't recommend you use it for, but it does work. Like, people have taken demo videos of them driving even without their hands on the wheel in traffic, and it seems fine, like in stop and go traffic. But the thing that they were saying is that even when there's a car that can handle highway driving with literally no human interaction, it doesn't necessarily mean they can handle driving down a rural street or driving in a parking lot to go find a parking space. Because like and Tesla has their summon feature that lets the car, like, it'll map your entire driveway and garage and all that. And so it can park in a very tight space, but you wouldn't be able to, like, a 12-year-old child wouldn't be able to get into a car, say go to daycare or something, and the car would be able to pull out of the driveway, pull onto the road, and like go through intersections, navigate all that, and then pull into, like, find an open parking space and pull into it. It would take a long time for an autonomous car to be able to do all of those little things, even if it can do 99% of tasks. For a car to be truly autonomous, it has to be able to do anything that a human driver can do. And that includes finding a parking space. Because otherwise, what use is a car if it gets to the parking lot and then goes, all right, you're here. Like, even if it would need GPS to that level, where it can't give up GPS. Like, if you've ever used a GPS device, which I'm sure you have driving, it just says, once you get within 100 feet or something of the destination, it's like, you have arrived. But a self-driving car has to do more than that. It has to get you into the space where you're going to park and put the car in park and turn off the engine and all of that.
Yeah. I've encountered times where I'll navigate using Google Maps or Waze or whatever to get to, say, like a stadium or a LRT station to catch a train. And I'll put in my Google Maps and it comes up and start navigating. It's like, okay, sweet. Start going there. And as I'm driving there, I'm realizing it's taking me to either a different entrance or the marker on Google Maps is pointed like literally right to the LRT yes. station, not to where you're supposed to park.
Yep.
So I have to like self-navigate yeah. to where I have to park and all that kind of stuff. And thankfully I know my way around so I can actually do that. But even if I was new to the city, I'd be like, where the heck is this taking me? I can't park here.
Yep.
So it's the kind of thing where you need to get the mapping technology to a point like you're alluding mm-hmm. to where you don't need to rely on your own abilities to drive and or navigate. Mm. Because, yeah, if it's to be of any use to someone who can't drive or doesn't know the roads or whatever, you need the car to be able to do that themselves.
Yeah.
It reminded me of, there's a show called Daniel Tiger. I don't know if you've ever heard of it or seen it, but it's a kid's show. And there's like this little trolley that kind of goes around to houses and it takes the characters to whatever place. And it pulls up to their house, say, oh, to the doctor's office, trolley, ding, ding. And it goes to the doctor's right. office. So it's kind of like they have their own level of autonomy there. Yeah. So I think... I'm looking forward to the point where we'll have our own trolleys that we can just summon yeah. and say to wherever, and it takes you there.
I had an anecdote from last fall where I was driving to the mall called Bayshore that I'd been to, but I'd never driven to it before. And so I had plugged it in just a pin on my, on Google Maps and hit go. I didn't really look at the end map before, and it's right next to the highway. And so it got me to exit the highway and I was like, okay, that's good. I'm off the highway now. And then it had me turn left, but then right off on the off ramp, it was just like, you have arrived. And I was still almost on the highway. And by the time I had made that left turn, unbeknownst to me, the only option I had once I had made that left turn was to turn on the on ramp back onto the highway. So right. I had to go like 5 kilometers down the road to the next exit and then loop back around to get to the mall. Whereas the GPS was just like, yeah, you made it to the mall. We did our job and nothing went wrong here. But from my perspective, anyone who had never been to the area before or had never done that particular route before and didn't have that knowledge in their head that they couldn't make that left turn because like it just wouldn't work, that pin being in that spot for Googling Bayshore Mall on Google Maps would mean that everyone who had done that had made the same mistake as me. And that is never caught as a bug or an edge case or anything because there's no feedback mechanism of like this route didn't work in the way you were expecting it to.
Right. Well, and that's, you know, going off on even a greater tangent, I found Waze is good
yeah.
for being able to edit maps. But the problem I had, because I've played around with it for a little bit and eventually went back to Google Maps because their location searching functionality mm-hmm. was left to be desired.
Right.
But the ability to flag where there's a map error and
yeah.
the response for them to, they literally interact with you and say, oh, so what's the issue that you're seeing with this map? And there's local, you know, Calgary-based Waze editors yeah. that will go in and make changes for you and that kind of thing. And you can be a map editor yourself, even if you yeah. wanted to. But it's a very interactive thing. Whereas with Google, I found, like, I've flagged locations before. And sometimes it's like, oh, no, we found that there's no issue here. And it's like, there is actually.
I actually reported an issue that's a real issue.
Yeah. And we've had times where I'll search, like, Tim Hortons. And it'll show up on the map as a location. I'll navigate there. And it's like a corporate headquarters.
Right.
It's not yeah. an actual restaurant location. It's like, guys, come on. Like, and like those I usually don't flag because it's like, oh, whatever.
Yeah. But yeah.
It's the ability to customize or not even customize, but just have it be correct based on user feedback is not as good with Google.
Yeah. Well, and we would be remiss without pointing this out. The fact that Waze was bought by Google a few years ago. And so they source a lot of their, like if you see an accident or construction on Google Maps, it's because someone reported it on Waze. So Waze is kind of like the beta of Google Maps in terms of mapping software itself, like the back end part. Waze right. is where they get that information. So anytime you report an error to Waze, Google will be incorporating that into their software in the future. Whereas the Google Maps engineers are looking for something that's very obviously visually wrong or that there's like some kind of mistake with the surface level stuff. But the underlying mechanism is all like powered a lot by Waze now because they were bought a few years ago and kind of incorporated things into the system. I assume right. that's why Waze and Google or like Waze wasn't shut down and its features brought into Google Maps because they're pretty different services, even though they're both on one level mapping GPS type software.
Huh. So it's almost like Waze is a beta version of Google Maps.
Almost. but like the just the back end part. The front end, they're totally different. Because the one, like Waze has, you can report red light cameras, radar, all that kind of stuff, construction.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it is, it very much is like a real live beta of Google Maps, where Google Maps is like the surface source for everyone. Anyone can use Google Maps and be totally fine, except for these edge cases. Whereas Waze, when you hit an edge case, you'd report that edge case because you're kind of going for this beta feedback type experience. It's almost like a beta layer for the real world in terms of driving and navigation.
Huh.
But yeah, it's
interesting. Because I forgot about that whole Google buying Waze. Because I remember that when Waze was pretty much restricted to just like Egypt and like those places where there might not have been as good Google Maps mapping. But then Waze started getting coverage in other areas, such as Calgary or whatever. Yeah. And by that point, I'd forgotten that Google bought them. But yeah, that's a good point that you're pointing out there.
And yeah. So and to close this up and go back to Tesla for a second for myself anyways, the fact that Volvo is working on this and throwing shade at Tesla, we know that Volvo is working on this because now they've said we're working on this fully autonomous thing. Tesla is also working on more autonomous stuff, and it remains to be seen. Like they said for sure that autopilot would be on all Model 3s by default. I think they said it was going to be on like at least the basic autopilot features. Right now, you have to pay, I think it's $3,000 extra to get autopilot turned on like the Model S. Unless, I think the ones that you buy, if you buy it now, it includes it. But back when it first launched, it was in beta and you had to pay more for it past a certain point. It's interesting that they did it that way because obviously the development of that technology takes time and money. But this is the kind of thing where they don't necessarily want a bunch of cars in their fleet to have these potentially dangerous technologies that people aren't used to. Like they want to have it be limited at the start to gather data, but gather it slowly and only among testers that know what they're getting themselves into.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you listened to the latest or one of the latest Hello Internets where Gray was speculating on the Tesla 3 being the first fully autonomous model. Yeah. And he referenced the fact that, that all the threes will have the basic autopilot. So it to me, it almost sounded like when you buy a phone, counting on it being updated to the next operating system. Like it's, and I don't think anyone would ever buy a car expecting it to be fully autonomous. Mm-hmm. Like I wouldn't anyway.
Unless it was announced ridiculous. And shown off
unless
to be
it was announced,
that way.
Of course. Yeah. But even then, it's like, oh yeah, it will. But it's like, I've had enough experience with phones that you can't always count on that.
Yeah, pre-launch, by the time the Model 3 actually gets updated and people can start ordering and putting together their stuff, I presume it will be different and better in certain ways. And that includes the software that goes into autopilot. Like there will be, there may not be the next level of announcement yet where they're saying we have these autopilot features ready and you don't need to ever touch your steering wheel. In fact, it doesn't have a steering wheel. In fact, it can fly now also. Like there's going to be something, but it's not going to necessarily be this huge step forward. It will just be kind of baby steps, I assume. Right.
Do we know what mapping system Tesla relies on or will rely on?
I think they have, it's mostly proprietary software because it learns on its own. So it reads lane markers. In the lane and it kind of senses traffic around you, but it learns itself. Like it's very, is it low level? It's not using any mapping data like GPS. Like there might be a GPS system, but it's not using that to drive. It's just driving in this lane of this road that you're on. And
I just mean if you're navigating somewhere,
right?
Like, and it knows to turn left or right.
It doesn't do that, I don't think. I think once you're getting off a highway, quote unquote, like once you have to make a turn, it doesn't handle that. It only handles curves in the road you're on. And like, you can like tap while you're in autopilot mode, you can tap like change lanes and it can handle that.
Right.
But I don't think it handles like making any kind of turns other than like summoning and parking.
So there's no native mapping and navigation system?
There'd be navigation, but not in conjunction with autopilot.
Okay, so you're still doing all this steering and
like
stuff.
It's for highway or one road driving so far.
And the navigation, I'm assuming, is Google data or
presumably or Bing like maps. There's a few there's even a few mapping sources like I think DigitalOcean is one of them. Maybe that's just for oceans. That has like that provide mapping data to Google as well. So they presumably provide it to other people. But I, as far as I know, Tesla isn't powered by Google Maps, I don't think.
Right. Similar to like Blue Marble. Like Blue Marble is another like mapping company that provides data to to bigger or to other companies to use in further detail. Yeah. So, okay.
So, yeah, I'm interested to see Honda's autopilot system, but until it actually exists, I'm going to assume it's not as good as Tesla's.
Right.
If
until they put their money where their mouth is, or show their hand anyway.
Yeah. The last piece of follow-up I had here is following up on something that was a long time ago that we talked about on the show. And I think it was you that brought it up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. This thing called Sci-Hub, where it was one woman that had amassed a bunch of papers, right? I assume this project is now bigger than her, but maybe it's not.
Yeah.
Because they're saying now the scale of this Sci-Hub, like it's called, they call it an academic paper piracy site. I don't know if I really want to categorize it that. Like, I would say most major journals are kind of pirating, like profiting off of other people's success too. Like, obviously, that's the way the system's set up, so it's not illegal or anything, but what she's
it's
doing.
Like how a record label.
Exactly.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Enforcing control over their
quote-unquote
artists. In this case, it's researchers.
Yeah. Right.
But everyone in the academic community knows how, if you've ever tried to Google a research paper and you're not partnered with a big university or college, it's going to cost you like $30 to $100 or some, like an exorbitant amount of money to look, even to rent, like look at a PDF of a document for 24 hours or something. If you want to buy it, it's just insanely expensive. And so this Sci-Hub basically is crowdsourced papers. So people buy them or institutions get them and then put them up on Sci-Hub. And so anyone who wants to look at this can just go to this pirated version of the paper as opposed to the one from the actual journals. And the update on it is saying that it's basically reaching a tipping point now, Sci-Hub, where science publishers are getting genuinely worried about their future of their business because it's become so popular and big. And there's the headline here from TechCrunch is that it's having its Napster moment in that it's kind of reaching public consciousness in the research community. So I don't know. When you brought it up, did you say you had used it once or that you had just, it had come across your radar?
Off the record, I may or may not have used it. But yeah, I first heard about it and have heard that it works.
Mm-hmm.
Just to recap, the way that it goes about obtaining these papers is when you look up a paper, it will find, similar to how like a Kodi box or XBMC, they'll have sources and they'll ping all the sources to see if it has that content and then it pulls that content. So this does a similar thing. And then it has login credentials for whichever sources that it goes and pulls that paper for you.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming it's some sort of cataloging lookup system that it uses when you look up a paper and you literally just paste in a URL of the thing that you're looking for and it does its thing and then says, yeah, we have it, or, oh no, we don't have this yet.
Yeah.
So it's a building database of papers. And generally, I think if it's a paper that's in the news and it's new enough, it'll probably have it because someone would have requested it already and they've sourced it. So it works really well for when you read a news article and it's like, oh, to read more, here's the actual paper. And it links to the paid version. Yeah. And you just look that up and you probably have it.
Right.
So
I have a hard time, because journals make so much money, I have a hard time feeling bad for them, similar to the way like music publishing came up, the exact same kind of formula. And you're comparing it to Kodi, which, as far as we talked about, isn't, like, it's gray area. It's not necessarily illegal to do that.
It's gray area in Canada.
Right.
At least as far as I know. I don't know about other countries.
And so in theory, this would also fall into that same gray area.
Yeah.
Unless there's precedent about it.
Yeah. Like in this case, if you use the Kodi analogy, the person doing the streaming isn't at fault or isn't doing anything illegal. So people hosting the content that's being streamed.
And so,
in this case, I'm assuming that Sci-Hub itself would be the one doing the illegal thing.
Yeah.
You looking it up might not be.
Right.
I don't know about that.
It really depends if Sci-Hub is indexing the content or indexing the content providers, or if they're the ones actually providing the content. And it sounds like she is, or they are now just indexing right. papers from what you were saying, that there's different sources and it looks through them all.
Yeah. if we want to extend this to the Napster analogy, the way that artists now have built up their revenue model on relying on their touring
yeah.
and merchandise and that kind of thing to support them versus record sales, mm-hmm. because I think from what I've read in the past that artists treat releasing a record as advertisement for their tour.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
Like that's not the revenue generation model is the record sales. So on the research side, if again, I don't know what the economics are, but I'm assuming that universities or the researchers are making some money by selling their papers to these
in
journals.
In theory, yeah.
In theory. So if journals start seeing that they're not getting their download counts or subscriptions or whatever
right.
now that this thing's around, is there an alternative for researchers to get funding?
Yeah.
But again, I don't think researchers got funding or a ton of funding from journals.
Right.
That was more maybe advertisement.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like the funding comes from just normal funding.
Right.
Like sponsorships yeah. in a sense, I guess.
Yeah.
Like you probably know a bit more about it being on that side of things.
I know some about it. Like for instance, it tends to be like you get government funding. And the stipulation, at least in Canada with government funding, is that you make your research open. I think you can, like, you're welcome to do it immediately and recommended to do it immediately, but you are required now, if you get an ENSER grant at least, to make your funding or to make your publications completely open and free within a year.
Okay.
Like, so they're trying to go as far as they can out of their way to say, yeah, I get you can have an exclusive, but really we want science to be something that's open and accessible to everyone, which is the same goal as Sci-Hub is having.
I was going to say that's literally what Sci-Hub's trying to do.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Like, and we've talked before about private funding and how some researchers run into hurdles with that, and they've resorted to Kickstarter or other yeah. crowdfunding yeah. methods, which have varied degrees of success. But yeah, I don't know enough about that side of things to know what things are involved in a private company deciding whether to invest in something. I'm assuming there just has to be an upside for the private company
yeah.
for them to make that decision, whether it's advertising and exposure or actually they're getting something out of the research itself.
Right.
Like I know Nick said before about how I think it was an auto company that was investing in a type of research on whatever. I can't even remember what it is at this point, but it's they have a benefit for that research being done because it could potentially help them, and they could have a thing of a first right of refusal clause in there on that research.
Yeah.
So whether they're gonna buy the patent or whatever type thing. So yeah, as far as Sci-Hub's concerned, I hope it motivates a change in the industry.
Yeah.
And for the time being, until Sci-Hub is literally shut down the same way Napster was. Which from what it sounds like they've been able to dodge it pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this article on TechCrunch that I found that I came across is coming from, an original report paper, study thing written by Science, like the journal Science. And so they're well aware of the thing and Sci-Hub is being very open about what they're doing. And the only thing that I see here, like they're kind of coloring the like Sci-Hub as bad by it's like the title of the article is "Who's Downloading Pirated Papers?" Everyone. It's like they're making it very clear that it's piracy, and that like the header image of this article on Science is this black map of the Earth with red dots. It looks like if you've ever seen those nuclear test maps where they say like
right.
As like every blip on this map is a nuclear bomb going off. It looks like that, right. But with papers being accessed, it's just like all over the Earth. This is happening all the time. And it just makes it clear to me that this is necessary because there are definitely parts of the world where people are doing research or want to do research, but don't have the funds to be accessing or to be coming up with levels of like they're not going to pay for each paper. They're going to want to be able to access any paper that this journal or this network of journals has, but they can't afford to pay the thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars that it actually requires. And so going to Sci-Hub is a way that those groups can access all research.
You know, it'd be a very meta thing.
What's that?
If someone use Sci-Hub to download this science paper on how bad Sci-Hub is.
I've never
I'm sure someone's already done that.
I've never heard someone pronounce that word meta. I'm very... What?
Versus meta?
Yeah.
It's meta.
I've never heard it pronounced that way.
Really? I always pronounce it meta.
Interesting. Like data and data.
Right.
So, yeah, I have never actually used Sci-Hub myself. I got out of the research community before it ever came up, but it definitely seems like the thing I would do now if I did need to go, because that probably will happen at some point working at NSERC doing data analysis.
Yeah.
That I'll have to go and download a paper. Yeah. And if I can't get it, then probably going to do this.
Right. Well, like I said, if a site or an article references a paper, like they're writing a story on a paper, I generally want to see at least the abstract of the original paper, like the full abstract. And that's what this could be used for, because those ones I'm not going to pay for. If I really was using a paper for work, then I would consider paying for it, or the company would consider paying for it. But for the average, you know, media consumer, they're not going to just pay for papers every time they want to, you know, cross-reference a story.
Right.
And I guess as a final note or thought, as a researcher, you probably still want the satisfaction of being published in an actual journal like Science or Nature or whatever.
Yep.
So I don't see journals going away the same way record labels haven't gone away.
Right.
But I'm hoping that, it becomes more open.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing that I'd even be okay with there being, you know, a 10 paper per month count or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Or they only release the abstract, and to read the full paper, you need to pay for it. Which I think is
10.
That was that?
After 10.
You, or whatever. Yeah. Like, because I think right now a lot of journals will let you read the abstract.
Yeah, the abstract is usually free.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. Hopefully it changes. Yeah. That's the bottom line. And I think that's the whole point of this project anyway.
Yeah.
Because they're not making any money off of it, at least as far as...
No, I don't see how they would be unless they have agreements in place with certain publishers. The last piece of that is to, like, the fact that there are open journals now. There are journals that say, you can submit papers to us for free and we'll publish them openly for free. And that is a thing. So we'll see if it's similar to independent record labels, but not necessarily as open.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely, there is a move in that direction at least.
Yeah.
Yeah. So did you want to talk a bit about your, the story that's been in the notes for a really, really long time that we have never gotten to?
Yeah. And I actually haven't really heard much about this in the news in general, except for the one day that it was kind of announced.
Yeah.
There was a project or a funding initiative called Breakthrough Listen that we had talked about previously, where there was funding from this guy named Yuri Milner to use two radio telescopes to listen for anything.
Yep.
Part of the SETI initiative, I believe. If I'm not mistaken, is it SETI?
For this particular project? I'm not sure.
The Breakthrough Listen one.
I would assume so.
I think it was, yeah. And it was the kind of thing where that was huge for them, because otherwise they would not have anything, basically. Mm. So this is what sounds like a second half of that funding initiative called Breakthrough Starshot, where they're essentially like firing a bunch of micro satellites into space to see what they encounter. Kind of like a spray and pray approach to the whole thing, which again is better than nothing. And that's kind of all you can do at this point, because we're not really, I think they're semi targeting the shot.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's literally a laser that's going to steer these satellites.
Right.
So that they're going to be directed towards something, I guess into an area that they're hoping is something to see, but the, it's $100 million funding. And when this came out, you had everyone or a lot of people saying, oh, that money could be, you know, put to way better use. There's, you know, starving people wherever and whatnot. But it's like, well,
yeah,
but, you know, you could say that about anything.
$100 million is not that much money.
Yeah. In the grand scale of things, it's not that much money in comparison to other things that get funded that are a lot more stupid than this. Mm-hmm. So, it's the kind of thing where you might find nothing, but you might find something too. And I think the pros of finding something are a lot higher than if you didn't do it at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're yeah, they call them like nanocraft or however you want to call it. But it's not like they're super, you know, tiny, but yeah, relative to a regular satellite, they're pretty small.
Yeah. The tough thing about this, as we get further and further, like going to Pluto is hard enough to just aim for where Pluto is going to be like 10 years down the road to be able to get as high resolution images as New Horizons got. Going for something like even the closest star, which is apparently one of their goals, Alpha Centauri system, that's 4 light years away. And it says in the article here that like 30,000 years is how long it would take us to get there at current technology speeds. There's this big topic in space travel, I guess, or faster, quote unquote, faster than light travel, that people are hesitant to send craft at the speeds that we're able to get to now, like what New Horizons is able to get to, which was really fast. Because if in 10 years we develop some technology that can go twice as fast, then sending the original craft was a complete waste. Because over 30,000 years, something that takes 10 years longer is nothing. And so the idea is at a certain point, even say if 1,000 years down the road, we come up with a way that can get to the nearest star in 500 years, it's still going to be way faster than that, even 15,000 years. And so there, at a certain point, there's going to be a tipping point. If it takes us 30,000 years to come up with something that can get there faster than light and say 9 months, then right, we should wait the 30,000 years, because otherwise we'll be wasting effort for those 30,000 years if that's when we're going to develop the technology. And obviously this is all like big guessing game, but the current theory is mostly on the side of the fact that it's only 4 light years away. If our current technology can get there in 30,000 years, we should spend a pretty good portion of that 30,000 years trying to diminish the amount of time it would take. But on the other hand, if we don't really max out that fast, we don't want to spend 10,000 years getting it down to only taking 20,000 years, because then we're not really saving any time. So it's this whole guessing game of trying to figure out how fast our technology is going to advance, whether we're going to get to some huge breakthrough where, like, faster than light travel, if you look at like Star Wars or Star Trek, where they have either like transporters or faster than light travel, you can't make that comparison. If we ever get to that technology, there's no use in even having this argument.
Yeah. I guess I don't know enough about Star Trek to know, but I'm assuming that even with a transporter, like, there's still a speed limit on information, isn't there?
In Star Trek?
Like, unless they're like entangled, so like particles, yeah, where it's literally like instantaneous.
It's instantaneous. Like, it's basically, in Star Trek, at least, in my understanding, is that it's instantaneous and it's not really ever explained in terms of any science that exists in the world. Right. But they were saying that the whole thing is, oh, you know, transporters are very limited. They only work over a certain distance. And there are rules, like, both things have to be stationary. You can't, like, if something is moving at light speed, you can't transport to it. There are all these rules with transporting in the like TV shows and the original material. But then in the newest movie, the newest original Star Trek movie, they were able to take like two people or three people or whatever, like Simon Pegg being one of them, and transport them onto a ship moving faster than light that was like super far away. And it's like, basically, why do we have spaceships at that point? If you can transport things to like any distance, any speed, and at that point, the entire concept of transporting things through space via non-teleportation methods is just a waste of time. And so if we ever get to a technology like that, then space travel itself becomes redundant, because we can just transport a craft, like a habosphere or whatever, to anywhere in the solar system, and we'll just be there. And if we use the 3D printing analogy and we send a transporter in a transporter, then we can colonize the entire universe instantly. But obviously the reality is, well, not obviously, in our understanding of the universe, that kind of thing is impossible, at least according to the current laws of physics. And so we need to make some amazing discovery, like something like traveling through higher dimensions would be needed to travel. And this like starts just melting your brain thinking about it. But at our current technology, we're looking at tens of thousands of years to get to even something that's very close. Whereas if you had faster than light travel, getting to something that is 4 light years away would take less than 4 years. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so there's a balance in there between 4 and 30,000 years where we should launch a spacecraft, and we're not, right. We're much closer to, we're at the 30,000 years now. Who knows if in 10,000 years we'll be close to that 4 years distance.
Right.
Like it's impossible to predict.
To put some distances and timeframes to this breakthrough Starshot project, they're just reading this article a bit further. They're actually targeting Alpha Centauri, which is the closest star system.
Proxima Centauri is the closest. That was my mistake when I first said it. Alpha Centauri is close, but not... Or is Alpha Centauri one of the Proxima Centauri system? I can't remember.
This article says it's the closest star system to our own. Okay. And I've heard that same thing before, so that seems to check out.
Yeah. I'm questioning myself now, not you.
Okay. And again, this article quotes that the spacecraft would take 20 years to reach the star system.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so it'd take another 4 years to come back. So that's the 4 light years number that you're referring to. Best case, you'd be waiting about 25 years to hear back from this original release of spacecraft,
right.
If anything mm-hmm. is found. And like you're saying, it takes today's fastest spacecraft 30,000 years to accomplish the same feat.
Yep.
So that's where the nano spacecraft with the light sails and laser guidance is a lot of a better option than sending out a spacecraft now, because you're way further ahead doing this.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess Proxima Centauri is there's two other stars that are right near it, a binary Alpha Centauri. So they're all right next to each other, basically.
Right.
There's three total stars.
Okay.
That's nice. Wikipedia has a beautiful little thing. Yeah, they're both about 4.2 or something light years away, which is what I had remembered. It's all very interesting. Space is so cool. I was talking to somebody a couple days ago about just how interesting space is. And they're like, you're such a nerd. What is happening? And I'm like, no, seriously, space is amazing. The fact that it's so big and you can start to get into, like, we're learning all kinds of stuff to do with particle physics and the early universe and Big Bang and the gravitational waves. Like, all these big discoveries are coming out now, and we're kind of in a renaissance of space exploration and space science. Just so fun to be alive at this time.
Yeah. When the best thing is, in these endeavors, you know, even as making these tiny spaceships or satellites to go out to explore space, in the development of these, and in the discovery of information that they find, you end up discovering other things that are, you know, quote unquote, more relevant to today's problems. You know, you can say that space exploration is a waste of money, but it's like, well, a lot of things that we have today wouldn't have been discovered or invented unless the space exploration was what was causing that invention.
Yeah, it's very true. So, this next story that I have doesn't really relate to anything that we've talked about so far. And it's actually quite a divergence from our usual topic, but I just thought it was an interesting thing. And having to do with apps and credit cards, like, at least I think about money all the time. Like, I have my really complicated budget spreadsheet, and the limiting factor for me in financial planning has always been the fact that credit cards are seriously outdated, specifically the technology behind, like, bank websites in relation to credit cards. I know that there are some cards, like Capital One, I know, for instance, does this, where as soon as you make a transaction, it shows up on the Capital One website. Like, when you log into your banking system, it shows your credit card transaction immediately. Whereas TD, which I've been using for my entire life, or since I was 18, at least, when I got my credit card, and before that with the debit card, debit has always worked like that, where you make a debit transaction, it shows up immediately. But credit cards, they authorize the transaction, but it doesn't actually go through for 3 or 4 business days. And so in trying to come up with my forecasting, I'm having to, like, try to remember back what I spent, or having to try to guess or estimate numbers. And this past week, TD rolled out an app called MySpend, which they ascribe as being a financial management app. So it looks at your purchases and it, like, slots things in. So if you go to the grocery store, if you go to, like, Loblaws or Superstore or whatever, it logs that as being groceries. Like, it has categorized all vendors into different categories, utilities, groceries, fine dining, fast food, whatever. Like, it splits everything into categories. But the biggest thing for me with this app is that when I spend something on my credit card, it before I can even like I walk out of a store having or a restaurant having made a purchase, I get my phone out to like look at Twitter or look, send a text message or something. And the transaction shows up. It sends me a push notification, says you spent money here. This is how much. And you can go into this My Spend app. This is something that's not available on the main TD app. You go into the My Spend app and it shows you all the pending transactions in addition to all your regular transactions. And so it lets you plan on a much more granular level your financial spending. And not only that, it lets me, for instance, keep track of things that I'm buying and all the transactions I'm making in real time in my budgeting spreadsheet. So I don't have to do any kind of guesswork. And I have to assume, I'll let you give your thoughts on this, but I have to assume that this is making its way into the TD like banking system in general, where you're gonna be able to see pending transactions in the ways that other major credit cards have.
Yeah, like PC MasterCard has the same thing, not the app, but they'll show your transaction at least same day. I haven't, you know, checked to see how quickly it is, but I'll spend something one day and then Ria will text me and be like, oh, did you buy something wherever? Because she'll look at the credit card statement before she pays it to make sure that all the transactions seem okay.
Yep.
Just in a fraud sense, not in a why did you spend that sense.
Sure.
But yeah, and it'll be something I bought like literally hours before. And it's like, oh yeah, that was today. And she's like, oh, okay, good. Like just to make sure. And it's like, oh, that's kind of cool that it shows up that quickly. Because yeah, like you were saying, it takes a couple of days for it to actually go through. Mm-hmm. But it will show up on the credit card online summary as a pending transaction.
Yeah.
I personally or we personally don't use any sort of budgeting tracking, so to speak. Like we have, I guess what you'd call a budget. Like we have an idea of how much things should cost every month.
Right.
And if the credit card bill is higher 1 month to another, it's like, oh, what did we spend? It's like, oh, we bought that big purchase or, oh, we put a deposit on this or whatever. And it's like, okay, that kind of makes sense. So it's not to the point where, you know, I go out and say, oh, I spent, you know, $5 on this lunch and, you know, I'll have to walk down. It's like, oh, do I have like, you know, enough of a budget for this? And you know, we're fortunate that we're not in a position to do that. I can understand that some people might want to be.
Yeah.
And that's where I think an app like this is useful. If you are, like you said, on a more granular level, trying to control and monitor your spending, if you don't know where it's coming from.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people have their own systems as well, like spreadsheets or whatnot. I think having an app that can read your statements and categorize things and that kind of thing is a really good thing. And from what I've heard from other financial planning sources, that is the best way to do it. It's not worth saying, oh, I spent this much on, you know, produce, this much on toiletries. It's like you go to the grocery store, that's how much you spent on groceries. Yeah. Like it doesn't matter, right? Mm-hmm. And over time it averages out and that's all you really care about is that kind of moving average, not, oh, I'm spending too much on toothpaste.
Right.
Like, who cares?
Yeah.
It's not worth the effort to kind of go into that unless you look into your cupboard, you have like 50 tubes of toothpaste. It's like, oh, maybe I don't need that much.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm hoping that this is a more widespread thing that credit card companies will be doing. And I'd love for there to be a MasterCard one. Like a PC MasterCard one, that's what we use. And if they had that, I totally like look at that, be like, oh, this month to last month, I spent more, you know, on fast food. Yeah. And then kind of just keep that in mind and be like, well, why did I spend more? And it's like, was it because I was too lazy to like make lunch that day? Was it because we were just busy that day and, you know, weren't around at home or whatever, right?
Right.
And those are the kind of things that you might try to keep in mind more the next month and say, well, you know, I don't need to eat out right now. We're heading home and we can just wait
if
that's the kind of thing. But
I love the idea of getting a push notification. Like I don't spend enough times per day that a push notification for every time I spend money on my credit card would be annoying. Mm-hmm. I'd much rather have that when if someone made a fraudulent transaction on my credit card, I would want to know by push notification. Like I'm happy getting those.
Right.
And I haven't used it. Really, I've only had it for a few days now. I haven't had it. I've never had credit card fraud taken on my account anyways, but I'm really intrigued to see how it changes my kind of financial outlook.
Yeah. For us, like, because it's a joint credit card, it wouldn't work as well because pretty much every time there's a transaction from the other person, it kind of send panic if right. that's what you're worried about. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, wait, oh, who's spending? Like, where was that? Like, I'd be okay if it was like, oh, there's a transaction originating from wherever. And it's like, right. Neither of us are there right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's actually what happened. I think I was telling you guys how our bank account, like the actual like debit yeah. bank account, was flagged because there are transactions like ATM withdrawals coming from like the Philippines or Indonesia.
Right.
And they call us like, we have these transactions. Can you just take a look at it? And it was, yeah, sure enough, it was withdrawals. It's like, yeah, that wasn't us.
Definitely not.
And it was flagged by their system because it was in like, the withdrawals were in random like Canadian currencies. It was like, you know, $52.35. Like, obviously that's not an ATM withdrawal that's even possible
yeah,
in
yeah.
Canada, but because of the conversion rate, that's what it worked out to be.
Right. And it was
like, you know, an even number of, huh. you know, Indonesian currency or whatever. Right.
Right.
So I'm sure that was baked into their system to flag that.
Yeah.
So I'm okay relying on the bank to flag it, especially because generally they're the ones that are liable
yeah.
for that type of thing. So, but yeah, I can see how having push notifications would be useful if that's something you're trying to
yeah.
to be and aware of.
I think like you can control which accounts it actually monitors, like which accounts okay. are built into the app. So you could do it on an account by account basis. Right. The thrust of this app is supposed to be for like basic financial planning. Like it lets you put things in categories and see where you're spending a lot, and it compares your spending to like previous months.
Yeah.
But the only thing that I use it for is like, I love these push notifications saying that I've spent some money.
Right. It's almost like a subconscious feedback. And I guess you could consider it kind of just an additional reminder that you're spending money. It's like almost seeing the money come out of your account.
Yeah.
So it's one thing to, you know, tap your card and it's done. But if you get a push notification, like, you spent this much. It's like, oh, I did. Like,
yeah.
And if it's something that you maybe were hesitant to spend or, you know, well, whatever, then it's like kind of that reinforcement of double checking if that was something that you wanted to buy.
Yeah.
Kind of.
So I really like this app, but I want to see the functionality extended to the actual like TD website, because it's really annoying. And I've been saying this for years. And when I heard the Capital One had a thing where you can see pending transactions on like online banking, I was immediately jealous and just thinking about getting a credit card that did that. And so if TD does that, then good on them, which it seems like they're going to, because they have the backend functionality built in. So
yeah,
I'm going to see, I'll see how this works out and maybe follow up if I have more issues or more things to say about it.
Okay.
So how about one more here? I want to hear this story about the Earl's restaurant, because we both have a vested interest in that company.
Right. I don't know about vested interest, but...
Well, we have had at one point in our lives yeah. a vested interest in the company that owns yes. Earl's.
Yeah. So this was the latest slacktivism situation that we've had, mm-hmm. more locally in Calgary and Alberta as a whole.
Right.
And I guess Canada in a greater sense, but mostly Calgary and Alberta, that the Earl's restaurant chain, who apparently have U.S. locations, I think.
Okay.
But for the most part, they're in Canada, and they, you know, obviously serve food and beef. And they recently came out and said that they've moved to a U.S. beef provider mm-hmm. instead of using Alberta beef. And the reason for that is because they're trying to move to certified humane beef, which is a certification system that looks at steroid-free, no antibiotic, you know, humane treatment, et cetera,
right.
of the beef, you know, that they're sourcing. And they actually tried to keep it to Alberta, but they had to use multiple beef providers that met the standard, mm. like to, in order to meet the volume that met the standard. And even then, they still couldn't beat that volume.
Huh.
So they've said that they've moved to a sole U.S. supplier for their certified humane beef.
Okay.
And of course, there's the outrage saying, you know, you're not using Alberta beef. Like, how could you? It's the best beef in the world. Support Alberta producers. And yeah, this is probably at like, you know, if not overtly, but at least behind the scenes, a business decision, because yeah. it makes way more sense to do a large volume with one producer
yeah.
than multiple producers that can't even meet your volume for that certified humane
sure.
Rating that you're looking for. But everyone was taking to Twitter and spreading it around and saying hashtag boycott Earl's hashtag, et cetera. Well, it's like, guys, like, and then, you know, of course, there's the other side saying, well, A, you really didn't look into or care where your food was coming from to begin with.
Yeah.
It's only because it's in the news and you're like aware of it. And then, you know, I don't know how true these things were, but it was saying that, you know, the keg only uses Alberta beef for 7% of their cuts. And, you know, A&W only uses Alberta beef for X percent of their products, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, this isn't just Earl's that is using US beef. You know, they might be using no Alberta beef now because they're trying to meet the standard, but like, you can't just, you know, boycott everyone that's not using Alberta beef because then you wouldn't be able to eat anywhere.
Right.
So it's like, to me, it shows more a downside of social media and the internet because, you know, with anything like this, like when it's stupid stuff, like, like, I think there's important issues that social media benefits where it's awareness and gets people talking about it, whatever. But this kind of thing, it's like, when has anyone, you know, except for the very small minority and, you know, where that's part of their lifestyle to, you know, be aware of where there's, you know, food, clothing, whatever is coming from. Mm-hmm. But the average person probably doesn't know and really shouldn't care where their stuff is coming from.
Right. And to a certain extent, I agree. There is something to be said for the environment to eat relatively locally, but caring that your beef was raised in Alberta, like to be Alberta proud and like support the Canadian industry, if it's financially better to do, or like in this case, supply chain, it sounds like Alberta doesn't have enough beef at the prices that Earls need to pay for the cuts they want, then
are certified humane.
Yeah. That you're either going to, I guess if you're going to cause a stir over this, it would probably be more productive to cause a stir to say, hey, Alberta beef providers, get your act together and do these things because you're losing business. But this move is just targeting Earls when Earls didn't do anything except try to save their customers some money and give them a good, like, humane product.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of what I took away from it is this should be a sign, you know, I haven't looked into the certified humane thing, but whether it's a, you know, BS designation.
Well, yeah.
But
the certified humane targeting a thing to be like steroid free, antibiotic free, all of this, like encapsulating humane as in like a catch all for environmentally conscious.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. Like I have a friend who is actually a cattle rancher and he was saying that at least at his ranch, you know, they are, you know, hormone free. They only use antibiotics when they're sick because that's a good time to use antibiotics.
That's why they exist.
Yeah. you know, and like they're not inhumanely, but they might not meet this standard.
Right.
But, and so, and I don't know anything about it to know whether that's a realistic or a beneficial standard to even meet.
Yep.
It'd be kind of like, you know, Alberta oil. Like there's a big thing about oil being dirty and whatever. And, you know, it's like, well, A, it's not as dirty as you think. And is that even a realistic thing? Like, is it a meaningful way, like a bar to set kind of thing, right? But yeah, like for me, the reason that I kind of wanted to talk about this was because it was like one day, like I think it was a couple days ago, just randomly it was like hashtag boycott Earls. Like, what the heck is going on here? So I look into it more and it's like, what the? It's beef and like, I just didn't understand this outrage over it. This outrage
directed at Earls.
At Earls specifically. Yeah. And it's like, guys, like, it's like, don't you have anything better to do with your day than to get upset at a restaurant trying to make a business decision?
Yeah.
And, you know, at least on the surface, encourage, you know, cows to be treated more humanely. Like, if Alberta was literally just bad to the cows, it's like, would you want to be like, oh, well, you should use us anyway? Mm-hmm. It's like, well, no, maybe just change your practices if that was the case.
Right.
But I don't know. I guess it's one of those outrages of the week that you see. And I don't know what else to say about it, but I'm not really one for boycotts. Like I went in last time I went into the liquor store and I was looking at, you know, what beer to buy. And I grabbed this one variety pack and looked at it. I was like, oh, this kind of looked interesting. And I wanted to know where it was brewed because I do like try to support the smaller breweries, whatever. And this one was brewed in like New Brunswick. And I'm like, I kind of want to support a local brewery. So I picked up a case of Big Rock and it's a, you know, Alberta, Calgary brewery. And it had some good beers in it too. I was kind of debating between the two. And I went for that one because I don't know, maybe it was a self-serving feel-good moment for me, but I do like to think that I can contribute to the success of these local breweries. But when it comes to, I wouldn't get mad at a beer store for not supplying a specific brand of beer. It's like, just, I don't know, like, it's just not worth it to me.
If there are other restaurants that have this more humane, no antibiotics, no steroids beef from Alberta, by all means, go to that restaurant. But that's not boycotting Earl's, and you shouldn't be boycotting Earl's because they chose to make this decision. They didn't do anything wrong. If you want to make a different choice, you are welcome to exercise that right. And you are welcome to tell people, hey, this company does have these things that Earl's can't do, but organizing a boycott doesn't make any sense. It's not productive. Really, you're probably just reminding more people like, oh, hey, Earl's pretty good. I remember we went there a few months ago. Yeah. And I liked it.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's like free publicity. Like, no one's going to remember this in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And people are going to like just continue going to Earl's. Like, no one's going to say, no, I'm not eating there anymore.
Yeah.
Like, I would love to, like, look at Chick-fil-A when they had that whole thing with their CEO or whoever. And it's like, no one remembers that anymore. People are still going to stop at Chick-fil-A if they're hungry. They're not going to be like, oh, no, I'm not going to eat there because whatever. It's like,
oh, and that, that was a slightly different thing. And I think some people have come to, like, there's a whole boycotting Target in North Carolina, or like that their CEO or some high level member said, was on the side of not letting transgender people use any of their washrooms.
Oh, really? Okay.
But like they wanted them to only use the washroom that was the gender they were given at birth. And there's a whole thing about this, like, that I get, because it's actually affecting people's lives.
Right.
And so not shopping at Target because of that seems like a much more valid reason than, it's not like they were outsourcing their, like, their washrooms are from like California and they people wanted their North Carolina washrooms. It's not as reasonable to organize a boycott over such a weirdly specific thing, as opposed to just taking your business